as an unwelcome prophet. Lederer struggled into a phone box, intending to call Carver, only to discover he had no English coins. He dived into the Mulberry Arms, fought his way to the bar, and bought a beer he did not want in order to have change. He returned to the phone box to find it didn't work, so he pelted back down the road in search of his driver, who, having watched Lederer march by with Brotherhood, had assumed he was no longer required, and had driven home to Battersea, where he had a friend. At 9 o'clock, Lederer burst in upon Carver at the US Embassy, where Carver was drafting a signal on the day's events.
"They're lying," Lederer shouted. "Who are?" "The fucking Brits. Pym's flown the coop. They don't know where he is from the man on the fucking moon."
I asked Brotherhood to pass him this totally subversive message, and he sweet-mouthed me to keep me off the track. Pym jumped ship at London Airport, and they're looking for him the same way we are. Those Czech radio transmissions are kosher. The Brits are looking for him, we're looking for him, and the fucking Czechs are looking for him all over. Listen to me! Carver had listened. Carver continued to listen. He took Lederer through his conversation with Brotherhood and concluded it should not have taken place and that Lederer had exceeded his competence. He did not say this to Lederer, but he made a note of it. And later that night, in a separate telegram to the agency's personnel people, he took care that this note was added to Lederer's file. At the same time, he accepted that Lederer might well have stumbled upon the truth, even if by the wrong route, and said this also. Thus, Carver covered his back always, while at the same time knifing an unpleasing interloper. Never bad. "The British are not playing this straight," he confided to people he knew at the top. "I am going to have to watch this very carefully." The headmaster's study smelt of killing bottles. Mr. Caird, though he hated violence, was a passionate lepidopterist. A grim portrait of our founder, G.F. Grimble, glowered down on cracked leather chairs. In one of them sat Tom. Brotherhood sat opposite him. Tom was looking at the photograph from the Langley folder on Petz Hampel Zaworski. Brotherhood was looking at Tom. Mr. Caird had shaken Brotherhood's hand and left them to it.
"That the one who walked your dad round the cricket ground in Corfu?" said Brotherhood, watching Tom.
"Yes, sir."
"You weren't far wrong with your description, then, were you?"
"No, sir.
I thought you'd be amused."
"I am."
"He doesn't limp in the photograph, so he doesn't look so hobbly. Had any letters from your dad? Phone calls?"
"No, sir."
"Written to him?"
"Don't know where to send it, sir."
"Why don't you give it to me?"
Tom delved inside his grey pullover and unearthed a sealed envelope with no name or address on it. Brotherhood took it from him and took back the photograph, too.
"That inspector fellow hasn't been back to trouble you, has he?"
"No, sir."
"Anyone else been?"
"Not really, sir."
"What does that mean?"
"It's just so odd you coming tonight."
"Why?"
"It's maths prep," said Tom. "It's my worst thing."
"I expect you'd like to get back to it, then."
He took Pym's crushed letter from his pocket and handed it across the gap.
"I thought you might like this bag, too. It's a fine letter. You should be proud."
"Thank you, sir."
"Your dad talks there about an Uncle Sid."
"Who's that?"
"If you're ever down on your luck," he says, "or if you need a warm meal and a laugh or a bed for the night, don't forget your Uncle Sid."
"Who's Uncle Sid when he's at home?"
"Sid Lemon, sir."
"Where does he live?"
"Surbiton, sir, by a railway."
"Old man, is he? Youngish?"
"He looked after Dad when he was small. He was a friend of Grandad's. He's got a wife called Meg, but she's dead."
They both stood up.
"Dad's still all right, isn't he, sir?" said Tom.
Brotherhood's shoulders stiffened.
"You're to go to your mother, do you hear? Your mother or me, no one else. That's if things get tough."
He pulled an old leather-bound box from his jacket pocket.
"This is for you."
Tom opened it. A medal lay inside with a piece of ribbon attached to it, crimson with narrow dark blue stripes on either side.
"What did you get it for?" said Tom.
"Sticking out dark nights alone."
A bell was ringing.
"Now run along and do your job," said Brotherhood. The night was foul. Gusts of rain tore across the windscreen as Brotherhood negotiated the narrow lane.
The car was a souped-up Ford from the firm's pool, and he had only to stroke the accelerator for it to lunge towards the hedge. Magnus Pym, he thought. Traitor and Czech spy. If I know, why don't they? How many times in how many ways do they need the proof before they act on it? A pub loomed suddenly out of the rain. He pulled into the forecourt and drank a scotch before going to the phone. Call me on my private line, old boy, Nigel had said, expansively. The man in the picture is our friend from Corfu, no question about it, Brotherhood reported. You're sure? I'm sure. The boy's sure. I'm sure he's sure. When are you going to give the order to evacuate? A muffled crackle while Nigel put his fist over the mouthpiece the other end, but not, presumably, the earpiece. I want those Joes out, Nigel. Get them out. Tell Beau to get his head out of the sand and give the order. Long silence. We're tuning in at 0500 tomorrow morning, said Nigel. Come back to London and get some sleep. He rang off. London was east. Brotherhood headed south, following the signs to Reading. In every operation, there is an above the line and a below the line. Above the line is what you do by the book. Below the line is how you do the job. The letter to Tom was postmarked Reading, he rehearsed. Posted Monday night or first thing Tuesday morning. He rang me on Monday evening, Kate had said. He rang me on Monday evening, Belinda had said. Reading station resembled a low red brick stable set at one end of a tawdry square. A poster in the concourse gave the times of coaches to and from Heathrow. That's what you did, he thought. That's what I'd do. At Heathrow, you put up your smokescreen about planes to Scotland, and then you hopped a coach to Reading to keep things nice and private. He considered the coach stop, then cast a long, slow look around the square until his eye fell on the ticket kiosk. He wandered over to it. The clerk wore a small metal wheel in the buttonhole of his jacket. Brotherhood put £5 in the tray. I'd like some change, please, to telephone. Sorry, mate, can't do, the clerk said, and went on with his newspaper. You could do it last Monday night, though, couldn't you? The clerk's head came up fast. Brotherhood's office pass was green with a red diagonal line drawn in transparent ink across his photograph. A notice on the back said that if found, it should be returned to the Ministry of Defence. The clerk looked at both sides of it and gave it back. I haven't seen one like that before, he said. Tall fellow, Brotherhood said. Carried a black briefcase. Probably wore a black tie as well. Well-spoken, nice manner. Had a lot of calls to make. Remember? The clerk vanished, to be replaced a minute later by a tubby Indian with exhausted visionary eyes. Were you on duty here Monday evening? Brotherhood asked. Sir, I was the man who was on duty on Monday evening, he replied warily, as if he might not be that man any more. A pleasant gentleman in a black tie. I know, my colleague has acquainted me with all the details. How much change did you give him? Good heavens above, what does that matter? If I elect to give a man change, that is my personal preference. A matter for my pocket and my conscience, that has nothing to do with anybody. How much change did you give him? £5, exactly. Five he wanted, five he got. What in? 50p, exclusively. He wished to make no local calls at all. I questioned him about this, and he was entirely consistent in his answers. I mean, where is the hardship in this? Where is the sinister element? What did he pay you with? To my recollection, he gave me a £10 note. I cannot be completely certain, but that is my imperfect recollection, that he gave me a £10 note from his wallet, accompanied by the words, "Here you are." Did the £10 cover his rail ticket too? This was totally unproblematical. The price of a second-class single fare to London is £4.30 exactly. I gave him 10 50s and the balance in small change. Now, have you any further questions? I seriously hope not. Police, you know. If it's one inquiry a day, it's half a dozen. Is this the man? Said Brotherhood. He was holding a photograph showing Pym and Mary at their wedding. But that is you, sir, in the background. I think you are giving the bride away. Are you sure you are engaged in an official inquiry? This is a most irregular photograph.
Is this the man? Well, I am not saying it is not. Put it that way.
Pym would take him off perfectly, thought Brotherhood. Pym would catch that accent to a T. He stood at the barrier, studying the timetable of trains leaving Reading Station after 11 o'clock on a weekday night. You went anywhere except to London, because London is where you bought your ticket to. You had time to make your maudlin telephone calls, time to write your maudlin letter to Tom. Your plane left Heathrow at 8:40 without you. By 8 o'clock latest you had done your turnaround. By 8:15, according to the testimony of the airport travel clerk, you had put up your little smokescreen about planes to Scotland. After that you hightailed it to the Reading-bound coach, pulled down the brim of your hat, and said goodbye to the airport as quickly and quietly as you knew how. Brotherhood went back to the coach timetable. Time to kill, he repeated to himself. Say you caught the 8:30 from Heathrow. Between 9:15 and 10:30 there were half a dozen trains in both directions out of Reading, but you caught none of them. He wrote to Tom instead. Where from? He went back to the square. In the neon-lit pub there, in the fish-and-chip shop, in the all-night cafe where the tarts sit. Somewhere in this dowdy square you sat down and told Tom what to do when the world ended. The telephone box stood at the station entrance, under a bright light that was supposed to deter vandals. Smashed glass and paper cups cluttered the floor. Graffiti and promises of love defaced the awful grey paint. But it was a good telephone for all that. You could watch the whole square from it while you said your goodbyes. A mailbox was let into the wall close by. And that's where you posted it, saying, whatever happens, remember that I love you. After which you went to Wales, or to Scotland, or you popped over to Norway to watch the migration of the reindeer. Or you hightailed it to Canada and prepared to eat out of tins. Or you did something that was all these things and none of them, in an upstairs room with a view of the church and the sea. Reaching his flat in Shepherd Market, Brotherhood was still not quite done. The firm's official police contact was a Detective Superintendent Bellows at Scotland Yard. Brotherhood rang his home number. "What have you got for me on that ennobled gentleman I mentioned to you this morning?" he asked. And to his relief, detected no note of reservation in Bellows' voice, as he read him out the details. Brotherhood wrote them down. "Can you do me another one for tomorrow?" "It'll be a pleasure." "Lemon, believe it or not. First name Sid or Sydney. Old chap, widowed, lives in Surbiton, close to a railway." Reluctantly, Brotherhood phoned head office and asked for Nigel of Secretariat. Belatedly, and in the teeth of more larcenous instincts, he knew he must conform, just as he had conformed this afternoon when he poured scorn on the Americans. Just as in the end he had always conformed, not out of slavishness, but because he believed in the fight, and, despite everything, the team. A lot of atmospherics followed while Nigel was located. They went over to scramble. "What's the matter?" said Nigel, rudely. "The book Artelli was talking about, the analogue," he called it. "I thought he was perfectly ridiculous. Bowie's going to take it to the highest level. Tell them to try Grimmelshausen's Simplicissimus, on a hunch. Tell them to be sure to use an early text." A long silence, more atmospherics. "He's in the bath," thought Brotherhood. "He's in bed with a woman, or whatever he likes." "Now, how are you spelling that?" said Nigel, warily. Chapter 10. Once again a willed brightness was overtaking Pym as he listened to the many voices in his mind. "To be king," he repeated to himself. "To look with favour on this child that was myself. To love his defects and his strivings, and pity his simplicity." If there was such a thing as a perfect time in Pym's life, a time when all the versions of himself were appreciated and playing nicely, and he would never want for anything again, then surely it was his first few terms at Oxford University, whither Rick had dispatched him as a necessary interlude to having him appointed Lord Chief Justice, and thus securing him a place among the highest in the land. The relationship between the two pals had never been better.
Following Axel's departure, Pim's final lonely months in Bern had seen a dramatic flowering of their correspondence. With Frau Ollinger barely speaking to him, and Herr Ollinger increasingly absorbed in the problems of Ostermundingen, Pim walked the city streets alone, much as he had done at the beginning. But at night, with the wall beside him silent, he penned long and intimate letters of affection to Belinda, and his one true anchor, Rick. Stimulated by his attentions, Rick's letters in reply took on a sudden stylishness and prosperity. The anguished missives from outer England ceased. The stationery thickened, stabilized, and acquired illustrious headings. First, the Richard T. Pym Endeavour Company wrote to him from Cardiff, advising him that the clouds of misfortune had been swept away, one and all, by a providence I can only regard as crackerjack. A month later, and the Pym and Partners Property and Finance Enterprise of Cheltenham was advising him that certain steps were now in hand for Pym's future, with a view to ensuring that he would never want for anything again. Most recently, a printed card of regal elegance was pleased to announce that following a merger agreeable to all parties, matters relating to the above companies should henceforth be referred to the Pym and Permanent Mutual Property Trust, Nassau, of Park Lane West. Jack Brotherhood and Wendy treated him to a farewell fondue on the firm. Sandy came, and Jack gave Pym two bottles of whisky and hoped their paths would cross. Herr Ollinger accompanied him to the railway station, and they drank a last coffee. Frau Ollinger stayed home. Elizabeth served them, but she was distracted. She had put on bulk around the tummy, though she wore no ring. As the train pulled out of the station, Pym took a look downward at the circus and its elephant house, and a look upward at the university and its green dome. And by the time he reached Basel, he knew that Bern had sunk with all hands. Axel was illegal. The Swiss informed against him. I was lucky to get out myself. Standing in the corridor somewhere south of Paris, he observed tears on his cheeks and vowed not to be a spy again. At Victoria, Mr. Cudlove was waiting for him with a new Bentley. What do we call you now, sir? Doctor or professor? Just Magnus will do fine, said Pym handsomely, as they pumped hands. How's Ollie? The new Reichskanzlei in Park Lane was a monument to prosperous stability. The bust of TP was back in place. Law books, glass doors, and a new jockey with the Pym colours winked assurance at him while he waited on leather cushions for a lovely to admit him to the state apartments. Our chairman will see you now, Mr. Magnus. They bear-hugged, both for a moment too proud to speak. Rick palmed Pym's back, moulded his cheeks, and wiped away his tears. Mr. Muspole, Purse, and Sid were summoned by separate buzzers to pay homage to the returning hero. Mr. Muspole produced a sheaf of documents, and Rick read the best bits of them aloud. Pym was appointed international legal adviser for life, and awarded £500 a year to be reconsidered as appropriate on the strict understanding he worked for no other firm. His law studies at Oxford were thus taken care of. He need never want for anything again. A second lovely brought Bubbly. She seemed to have nothing else to do. Everybody drank the health of the company's newest employee.
Come on, Titch, let's have it in the parley-voo, cried Sid excitedly,
and Pym obliged by saying something fatuous in German. Father and son hugged again. Rick wept again, and said if only he had had the advantages. The same evening, at a mansion in Amersham called the Furlong, his homecoming was again celebrated by an intimate party of 200 old friends, few of whom Pym had seen before, including the heads of several world-famous corporations, leading stars of stage and screen, and several great barristers, who one by one took him aside and claimed the credit for obtaining a place for him at Oxford. The party over, Pym lay wakefully in his four-poster, listening to the expensive slamming of car doors.
You did a fine job out there in Switzerland, son, said Rick, from the dark, where he had been standing for some while. You fought a good fight. It's been noticed. Enjoy your dinner. It was really good. A lot of people said to me, Ricky, they said, you've got to get that boy back. Those foreigners will make a whore of him. You know what I said to them?
What did you say to them?
I said I had faith in you. Have you got faith in me, son?
Masses. What do you think of the house?
It's wonderful, said Pym.
It's yours. It's in your name. I bought it from the Duke of Devonshire.
Well, thank you very much, anyway.
Nobody can ever take it away from you, son. You can be 20, you can be 50. Where your old man is, that's home.
Did you talk to Maxie Moore at all?
Why, I don't think I did.
The fellow who scored the winning goal for Arsenal against Spurs?
Go on, of course you did.
What did you think of Blotsy?
Which one was he?
G.W. Blot. One of the most famous names in the retail grocery world you'll ever meet. That marvellous dignity. He'll be a lord one day.
So will you. What do you think of Sylvia?
Pym recalled a bulky, middle-aged woman in blue with an aristocratic smile that could have been the bubbly.
She's nice, he said cautiously.
Rick seized on the word as if he had been hunting for it half his life. Nice. That's what she is. She's a damned nice woman with two first-class husbands to her credit.
She's really attractive, even for my age.
Did you get yourself involved out there?
There's nothing can't be put right in this world by good pals.
Just the odd affair, nothing serious.
No woman's ever going to come between us, son. Once those Oxford girls know who your old man is, they'll be after you like a pack of wolves. Promise you'll keep yourself clean.
I promise.
And learn your law as if your life depended on it. You're being paid, remember?
I promise.
Well then.
The stealthy weight of Rick's body landed like a 16-stone cat at Pym's side. He pulled Pym's head towards his own until their two cheeks were pressed, stubble to stubble. His fingers found the fatty parts of Pym's chest under his pajama top and kneaded them. He wept. Pym wept, too, thinking again of Axel. The next day, Pym moved hastily into his college, claiming a variety of urgent reasons for going up 2 weeks early. Declining the services of Mr. Cudlove, he travelled by bus and gazed in mounting wonder at flowing hills and mown cornfields glowing in the autumn sunlight. The bus passed through country towns and villages, down lanes of russet beech trees and dancing hedgerows, till slowly the golden stone of Oxford replaced the Buckinghamshire brick. The hills flattened, and the city's spires lifted into the thickening rays of afternoon. He dismounted, thanked the driver, and drifted through the enchanted streets, asking his way at every corner, forgetting, asking again, not caring. Girls in bell skirts skimmed past him on their bicycles. Dons in billowing gowns clutched their mortarboards against the wind. Bookshops beckoned to him like houses of delight. He was lugging a suitcase, but it weighed no more than a hat. The college porter said, "Staircase 5," across the chapel quad. He climbed the winding wooden stairs until he saw his name written on an old oak door, M.R. Pym. He pushed the second door and closed the first. He found the switch and closed the second door on his whole life till now. I am safe inside the city walls. Nobody will find me, nobody will recruit me. He tripped over a case of legal tomes. A vase full of orchids wished him, "Godspeed, son, from your best pal." A Harrod's invoice debited them to the newest Pym consortium. University was a conventional sort of place in those days, Tom. You would have had a good laugh at the way we dressed and talked and the things we put up with, though we were the blessed of the earth. They shut us in at night and let us out in the morning. They gave us girls for tea, but not for dinner, and God knows not for breakfast. The college scouts doubled as the dean's joes and ratted on us if we broke the rules. Our parents had won the war, or most people's had, and since we couldn't beat them, our best revenge was to imitate them. Some of us had done national service. The rest of us dressed like officers anyway, hoping no one would notice the difference. With his first check, Pym bought a dark blue blazer with brass buttons. With his second, a pair of cavalry twill trousers and a blue tie with crowns that radiated patriotism. After that, there was a moratorium, because the third check took a month to clear. Pym polished his brown shoes, sported a handkerchief in his sleeve, and groomed his hair like a gentleman's. And when Sefton Boyd,
who was a year ahead of him, feasted him in the exalted gridiron club. Pym made such strides with the language that in no time he was talking it like a native, referring to his inferiors as Charlies, and to our own lot as the Chaps, and pronouncing bad things Harry Awful, and vulgar things Poggy, and good things Fairly Decent.
"Where did you pick up that Vincent's tie, by the by?" Sefton Boyd asked him kindly enough as they sauntered down the broad for a game of shove halfpenny with some Charlies at the Trinity pub.
"Didn't know you were boxing, Blue, in your spare time."
Pym said he had admired it in the window of a shop called Hall Brothers in the High Street.
"Well, put it on ice for a bit, I should. You can always get it out again when they elect you."
Carelessly, he put a hand on Pym's shoulder.
"And while you're about it, get your scout to sew some ordinary buttons on that jacket. Don't want people thinking you're the pretender to the Hungarian throne, do we?"
Once more, Pym embraced everything, loved everything, stretched every sinew to excel. He joined the societies, paid more subscriptions than there were clubs, became college secretary of everything from the philatelists to the euthanasians. He wrote sensitive articles for university journals, lobbied distinguished speakers, met them at the railway station, dined them at the society's expense, and brought them safely to empty lecture halls. He played college rugger, college cricket, rode in his college eight, got drunk in college bar, and was by turn ruthlessly cynical towards society and stalwartly British and protective of it, depending on whom he happened to be with. He threw himself afresh upon the German muse, and scarcely faltered when he discovered that at Oxford she was about 500 years older than she had been in Bern, and that anything written within living memory was unsound. But he quickly overcame his disappointment. "This is quality," he reasoned. "This is academia." In no time he was immersing himself in the garbled texts of medieval minstrels with the same energy that in an earlier life he had bestowed on Thomas Mann. By the end of his first term, he was an enthusiastic student of Middle and Old High German. By the end of his second, he could recite the Hildebrandslied and intone Bishop Ulfilla's Gothic translation of the Bible in his college bar, to the delight of his modest court. By the middle of his third, he was romping in the Parnassian fields of comparative and putative philology, where youthful creativity has ever had its fling. And when he found himself briefly transported into the perilous modernisms of the 17th century, he was pleased to be able to report, in a 20-page assault on the upstart Grimmelshausen, that the poet had marred his work with popular moralizing and undermined his validity by fighting on both sides in the 30 Years' War. As a final swipe, he suggested that Grimmelshausen's obsession with false names cast doubt upon his authorship.
"I shall stay here forever," he decided. "I shall become a don and be a hero to my pupils."
To entrench this ambition, he worked up a selective stammer and a self-denying smile, and at night sat long hours at his desk, keeping himself awake on Nescafe. When daylight came, he ventured downstairs unshaven, so that all might see the lines of study etched upon his eager face. It was on one such morning that he was surprised to find a case of vintage port waiting for him, accompanied by a note from the Regius Professor of Law.
"Dear Mr. Pym, yesterday Messrs. Harrods delivered the enclosed to me, together with a charming letter from your father, which appears to commend you to me as my pupil. While it is not my habit to turn away such generosity, I fear that the gesture is better directed to my colleague in the Modern Languages School, since I understand from your senior tutor that you are reading German."
For half the day, Pym did not know where to put himself. He turned up his collar, wandered miserably in Christchurch Meadows, cut his tutorial for fear of being arrested, and wrote letters to Belinda, who was working as an unpaid secretary to a London charity. In the afternoon, he sat in a dark cinema. In the evening, still in despair, he carted his guilty parcel to Balliol, determined to tell Sefton Boyd the whole story. But by the time he got there, he had thought of a better version.
"Some rich shit in Merton is trying to get me to go to bed with him," he protested, in the tone of healthy exasperation he had been practicing all the way to the gates. "He sent me a hairy great case of port to buy me over."
If Sefton Boyd doubted him, he did not let it show.
Between them, they carried their booty to the Gridiron Club, where six of them drank it at a sitting,
fitfully toasting Pym's virginity till morning. A few days later, Pym was elected a member. When the vacation came, he took a job selling carpets at a shop in Watford. A lawyer's vacation course, he told Rick. Similar to the holiday seminars he had attended in Switzerland. In reply, Rick sent him a 5-page homily, warning him against airy-fairy intellectuals, and a cheque for £50. That bounced. A summer term was devoted entirely to women. Pym had never been so in love. He swore his love to every girl he met. He was so anxious to overcome what he assumed would be their poor opinion of him. In intimate cafes, on park benches, or strolling beside the Isis on glorious afternoons, Pym held their hands and stared into their puzzled eyes and told them everything he had ever dreamed of hearing. If he felt awkward today with the one, he swore he would feel better tomorrow with the next. For women of his own age and intelligence were a novelty to him, and he became disconcerted when they did not assume a subordinate position. If he felt awkward with all of them, he wrote to Belinda, who never failed to reply. His love talk was never duplicated. He was not a cynic. To one, he spoke of his ambitions to return to the Swiss stage, where he had been a runaway success. She should learn German and come away with him, he said. They would act together. To another, he painted himself as a poet of the futile, and described his persecution at the hands of the murderous Swiss police. "But I thought they were so terrifically neutral and humane," she cried, appalled by his descriptions of the beatings he had received before being marched over the border into Austria. "Not if you're different," Pym said grimly. "Not if you refuse to conform with the bourgeois norm. Those Swisses have 2 laws that really matter out there. Thou shalt not be poor, and thou shalt not be foreign. I was both." "You've really been through it," she said. "It's fantastic. I haven't done anything at all." And to a third, he portrayed himself as a novelist of the tortured life, with work that he had yet to show his publishers, all stashed away in an old filing cabinet at home. One day, Jemima came. Her mother had sent her to an Oxford secretarial college to learn typing and go to dances. She was long-legged and distraught, like someone always late. She was more beautiful than ever. "I love you," Pym told her, handing her bits of fruitcake in his room. "Wherever I was, whatever I was having to endure, I loved you all the time." "But what were you having to endure?" Jemima asked. For Jemima, an extra kind of specialness was needed. Pym's reply took him by surprise. Afterwards, he decided that the answer had been lying in wait inside him, and leapt out before he could prevent it. "It was for England," he said. "I'm lucky to be alive. If I tell anyone about it, they'll kill me." "Why ever will they do that?" "It's secret. I swore never to tell." "Then why are you telling me?" "I love you. I had to do awful things to people. You can't imagine what it's like, carrying secrets like that alone." As Pym heard himself saying this, he remembered something that Axel had told him shortly before the end. "There is no such thing as a life that does not return." The next time he met Jemima, he described a brave girl he had worked with when he was doing his terribly secret work. He had in mind one of those muddy war photographs of beautiful women who win George medals for being parachuted weekly into France. "Her name was Wendy. We did secret missions into Russia together. We became partners." "Did you do it with her?" "It wasn't that kind of relationship. It was professional." Gemma was fascinated. "You mean she was a tart?" "Of course she wasn't. She was a secret agent like me." "Have you ever done it with a tart?" "No. Kenneth has. He's done it with 2. One each end." "Each end of what?" thought Pym, in rampant indignation. "Me? A secret hero, and she talks to me about sex?" In his despair, he wrote Belinda a 12-pager about his platonic love for her. But by the time her reply came, he had forgotten the context of his feelings. Sometimes Jemima came uninvited, wearing no makeup and her hair shoved behind her ears. She lay on the bed and read Jane Austen on her tummy, while she kicked a bare leg in the air or yawned. "You can put your hand up my skirt if you like," she said. "I'm fine, thanks," said Pym. Too polite to disturb her further, he sat in the chair and read A Handbook of Old High German Literature, till she made a grimace and left. For a while after that, she didn't visit him. He kept glimpsing her in cinemas, of which there were 7, so he got round them nicely in a week. Always she was with another man, and once, like her brother, she had 2. Once during this same period, Belinda came to stay with her, but told Pim she should keep away from him because it wasn't fair on Jem. Pim's need to impress Jemima now took on wild dimensions. He ate his meals alone and looked haunted, but she still didn't come to him. One evening, passing a brick wall, he deliberately dashed his knuckles against it until they bled, then hurried to her expensive lodgings in Merton Street, where he found her drying her long hair before the electric fire. "Who have you been fighting?" she asked, as she dabbed on iodine. "I can't talk about it. Some things never go away." Laying the fire on its back, she cooked him toast while she went on brushing her hair and watching him through the strands. "If I were a man," she said, "I wouldn't waste my energy hitting anybody. I wouldn't play rugger. I wouldn't box. I wouldn't spy for people. I wouldn't even ride. I'd save everything I had for fucking, again and again and again." Pim departed, once more smouldering at the frivolity of those who failed to perceive his higher calling. "Dearest Belle, is there nothing you can do for Jemima? I simply cannot bear to see her go to the devil like this." Did Pim know that he had tempted God? Certainly I know it now, this blowy night beside the sea, as I try to write it so many years later. Whom else but his maker was he provoking as he spun his stupid stories? Pim was calling down his fate on himself as surely as if he had begged for it by name in his prayers. And God dealt him the favour, as God often did. Pim's fantasy version of himself waited out there like a decoy that no celestial eye could overlook. And the divine response was lying in his cubbyhole in the porter's lodge, not 24 hours later, when he came down to see who loved him this Saturday morning, before breakfast. Ah, a letter! Blue in colour! Can it perhaps be from Jemima? Or is it from the virtuous Belinda, Jemima's friend? Is it from Lalagy, perhaps, or Polly, or Prudence, or Anne? The answer, Jack, was none of them. It came like so many bad things, from you. You were writing to Pim from Oman, care of the Trucial Oman Scouts, though the stamp was true blue British and the postmark Whitehall, because it had come to England by bag. "My dear Magnus, as you will see from the letter heading, I have abandoned the flesh pots of Bairn for harsher fare, and am presently attached to the military mission here, where life is certainly a lot more exciting. I still do the odd spot of church work, and I must say some of these Arabs sing pretty nicely. The purpose of my letter is twofold. One, to wish you all the best with your studies, and to repeat my interest in your progress. Two, to tell you that I have passed your name to our sister church back in the old country, since I gather they are a bit short of tenors in your region. So if you should chance to hear from a chap called Rob Gaunt, who tells you he is a friend of mine, I trust you will allow him to buy you a meal on my behalf, and make sure he does you proud. Incidentally, he is a lieutenant colonel, nominally a gunner." Pim had not long to wait, though every minute seemed a year. On the following Tuesday, returning from a testing tutorial on the theory of Ablaut, he found a second envelope waiting for him. This one was brown and of exceptional thickness, of a type I never saw in later years. Faint lines ran across it, giving it the appearance of corrugated cardboard, though the texture was oily and smooth. There was no crest on the back, no address of sender. Even the manufacturer was secret. Yet Pim's name and address were immaculately typed, the stamp perfectly centered, and when he probed the flap in the safety of his room, he discovered that it was stuck down with a rubberized bonding, which smelt of acid drops, and parted in sticky threads like chewing gum. Inside lay a single sheet of thick white paper that was not so much folded as ironed. Prizing it open, the great spy observed at once the absence of a watermark. The type was large, as if for the partially sighted, the alignment faultless. Box 777, the War Office, Whitehall, SW1. "My dear Pym, our mutual friend Jack tells me excellent things about you, and I would greatly like the opportunity to get to know you, as there are important matters of mutual interest that you might help us out with. Unfortunately, I have a full program at the moment, and shall be abroad by the time you receive this letter.
I wonder, therefore, whether, as an interim measure, you would care to have a conversation with a colleague of mine who will be down your way on Monday of next week. If you are willing, why not take the bus to Burford and be in the saloon bar of the Monmouth Arms a little before midday? For ease of recognition, he will be carrying a copy of Rider Haggard's Alan Quatermain, and I suggest you provide yourself with the Financial Times, which has a distinctive pink. His name is Michael, and, like Jack, he had a valuable war. I have no doubt the two of you will hit it off famously. With all good wishes, yours sincerely, R. Gaunt, Lieutenant Colonel R.A., retired. For the next 5 days, Pym abandoned work. He paced the back streets of the city, turning in his tracks to see who was following him. He bought a sheath knife and practiced throwing it at trees until the blade broke. He wrote a will and sent it to Belinda. When he entered his rooms, he did so with circumspection, never descending or climbing his staircase without first listening for unfamiliar sounds. Where should he hide the secret letters? They were far too precious to throw away. Remembering something he had read, he gouged out the centre of his brand new copy of Kluger's Etymological Dictionary to make a nest for them. From then on, his eviscerated Kluger became the first thing his eye fell upon when he returned from his sorties. To buy his copy of the Financial Times without attracting notice, he walked all the way to Littlemore, but the village post office had never heard of it. By the time he returned to Oxford, everything was shut. After a sleepless night, he made a dawn raid on the junior common room before anyone was up, and stole a back number from the racks. Two buses went to Burford on weekday mornings, but the second left him only 20 minutes to find the Monmouth Arms, so he took the first and got there at 9:40, only to discover that the bus dropped him at the door. In his over-alert condition, the inn sign, with its bold lettering, struck him as a breach of national security, and he strode past it with averted eyes. The rest of the morning crawled along on feet of lead. By 11 o'clock his notebook was already crammed with the number of every parked car in Burford, as well as copious notes on suspicious passers-by. By 11:58, duly seated in the saloon bar of the Monmouth Arms, he was seized by panic. Was he in the Monmouth Arms or the Golden Pheasant? Had Colonel Gaunt said the Winter's Tale? In the furnace of Pym's mind, these possibilities fused themselves into a brilliant and appalling alloy. He stepped into the forecourt and covertly reread the inn sign before hastening to the outdoor gentleman's to throw cold water in his face. Standing at a stall, he heard the sound of wind breaking and divined a bulky figure in a navy blue mackintosh standing at his side. The body was tilted backwards and sideways. The eyes were cast upward in agony. For a frightful moment, Pym feared the man was shot, until he realized that these contortions were caused by the difficulties of retaining a thick volume wedged under his armpit. Unable to perform, Pym buttoned himself, hurried back to the saloon, and, laying his Financial Times on the bar, ordered himself a bitter. "Make that two, will you, sport?" a breezy voice told the barman. "Uncle's in the chair today. How are you? What about over there in the corner? Don't forget your paper." "I won't give you much of our courtship, Jack. When two people have decided to go to bed with each other, what passes between them before the event is a matter of form rather than of content. Nor do I remember very clearly what justifications we cooked up, for Michael was a shy man who had spent most of his life at sea, and his rare snatches of philosophy came out of him like escaping steam signals, while he pummeled his mouth with a check handkerchief. Somebody's got to dredge the drains, oh boy. Fire with fire, only way, unless we want the buggers to steal the ship from under us, which I don't, thank you." This last being a tensely underplayed statement of personal faith, which he at once smothered with a swig of beer. "Michael was the first of your surrogates, Jack, so let him do duty for the rest. After Michael, if I remember, came David, and after David and Alan, and after Alan, I forget. Pym would see no flaw in any of them, or if he did, he translated it at once into a fiendishly clever piece of deception. Today, of course, I know the poor souls for what they were, members of that large lost family of the British unprofessional classes, which seems to wander by right between the secret services, the automobile clubs, and the richer private charities. Not bad men by any means, not dishonest men, not stupid, but men who see the threat to their class as synonymous with the threat to England, and never wandered far enough to know the difference. Modest men, practical, filling in their expense accounts and collecting their salaries, and impressing their Joes with their quiet expertise beneath the banter, yet still, in their secret hearts, nourishing themselves on the same illusions that in those days nourished Pym, and needing their Joes to help them do it. Worried men, touched with an odour of pub meals and club squash, and a habit of looking round them while they paid, as if wondering whether there was a better way to live. And Pym, as he was passed from hand to hand, did his best to honour and obey each one of them. He believed in them. He cheered them with witty stories from his ever-increasing store. He strained to give them treats and make their day exciting. And when it was time for them to go, he was always careful to have saved for them some last nugget of information to take home to their parents, even if sometimes he had to make it up. "How's the Colonel?" Pym ventured one day, belatedly recalling that Michael was still officially the stand-in for a Colonel Gaunt. "Not a question I ever ask personally, old boy," said Michael, and to Pym's surprise began snapping his fingers, as if he were summoning a dog. Did Rob Gaunt exist? Pym never met him, and later, when he was in a better position to ask, he could find nobody who would admit to having heard of him. Now the brown envelopes flow in thick and fast, often two or three a week. The college porter grows so used to seeing them, he chucks them into Pym's pigeonhole without reading the address, and Pym has to gouge out the centre of another dictionary to accommodate them. Always they contain instructions, and sometimes they contain small sums of cash, which the Michaels call his hard-lying money. Better still is Pym's float for operation expenses, which is kept at a fabulous £20. To entertaining secretary, Oxford University Hegelian Society, 7 and 9. Contribution to Peace in Korea campaign, 5 shillings. Bottle of sherry for Society of Cultural Relations with the USSR get-together, 14 shillings. Coach trip to Cambridge for goodwill visit to Cambridge University branch members, plus entertainment, £1.15 and 9. At first, Pym is timid of these claims, fearing that by making them he is straining his master's indulgence. The Colonel will find someone cheaper, someone richer, someone who knows that gentlemen do not count the cost. But slowly he comes to realise that, far from displeasing his masters, his expenditures are taken as evidence of his industry. "Dear old friend," wrote Michael, observing his own dictum that names must be avoided, lest the enemy intercept our correspondence. 11. "Thanks for your 8, safely to hand, a pearl as usual. I took the liberty of passing your rendering of the clan's latest choral to our lord and master upstairs, and I haven't seen the old boy laugh so much since his aunt caught her left doodah in the You've Got It. Brilliant and informative, dear sir, and be advised that the great man himself remarked upon your perseverance. Now, to the usual shopping list. 1. Are you certain that our distinguished clan treasurer spelt his name with a Z and not an S? The Doomsday Book contains an Abraham S, mathematician, late of Manchester Grammar School, who fits the bill, but definitely no Z, though it's always possible, of course, that a gentleman of his tartan spells it both ways anyhow. Don't force it, as the bishop said, but if Lady Luck pushes the answer your way, let us know. 2. Please keep your ever-sharp ear open for talk about our gallant Scottish brethren getting up a delegation to attend the Sarajevo Youth Festival in July. The powers that be are getting unaccountably miffed about gents who accept large government grants, only to oil off abroad and spit on said government shadow. 3. Regarding the distinguished visiting vocalist from Leeds University, who is slated to address the clan on the 1st of March, do please keep an eye and an ear open for his faithful spouse, Magdalene, God bless us, who by repute is quite as musical as her old man, but prefers to keep her head down owing to her delicate scientific interests. All comments gleefully received. Why did Pym do it, Tom? In the beginning was the deed, not the motive, least of all the word. It was his own choice. It was his own life. No one forced him. Anywhere along the line, or right at the start of it,
He could have yelled no and surprised himself. He never did. It took another 10 university generations before he threw in the sponge. And by then the lines were drawn for good, all the lines. Why chuck away his freedom and good luck, you will ask? His good looks and good humour and good heart, just when they were coming into their own at last. Why befriend a bunch of grimy and unhappy people of alien background and mentality, press himself upon them, all smiling and obliging? Because, believe me, there was no glamour to the university left by then. Berlin and Korea had put pay to that for good, merely in order to be able to betray them. Why sit whole nights away in back rooms among sullen girls from the provinces who scowled and ate nut cutlets and took firsts in economics, in order to profess a view of the world that he had to learn as he went along, twisting his mind inside out, killing himself on cheap cigarettes, while passionately agreeing that everything that was fun in life was a damn shame? Why do a father Murgo on them, offering his bourgeois origins for their condemnation, abasing himself, revelling in their disapproval, yet gaining no absolution from it, only to rush off and bang the scales down the other way in a gush of embellished reports of the night's proceedings? I should know. I have done it, and I have made others do it, and I was never less than cogent in my persuasion. For England. So that the free world can sleep safely in its bed at night, while the secret watchers guard her in their rugged care. For love. To be a good chap. A good soldier. A.B. Ziegler's name, whether with a Z or an S, was written, you may be sure, in capitals on every left-wing poster in every college lodge of the university. A.B. was a publicity-crazed, pipe-smoking sex maniac, about 4 feet high. His one ambition in life was to be noticed, and he saw the depleted left as a fast lane to this end. There were a dozen painless ways in which Michael and his people could have found out whatever they wanted about A.B., but Pym had to be their man. The great spy would have walked all the way to Manchester, just to look up Siegler, or Ziegler, in the phone book. Such was the drive with which he had flung himself into his secret mission. This is not betrayal, he told himself, when he was being the Michael's man. This is the real thing. These strident men and women with their college scarves and funny accents, who refer to me as our bourgeois friend, are my own countrymen, planning to upset our social order. For his country, or whatever he called it, Pym addressed envelopes and memorized the addresses, played steward at public meetings, marched in dispirited processions, and afterwards wrote down whoever came. For his country, he took any menial job going if it earned him favour. For his country, or for love, or for the Michaels, he stood at street corners late at night, offering unreadable Marxist pamphlets to passers-by who told him he ought to be in bed, then dumped the surplus copies in a ditch, and put his own money into the party kitty, because he was too proud to reclaim it from the Michaels. And if occasionally, as he sat up still later, writing his meticulous reports on tomorrow's revolutionists, the ghost of Axel materialized before him, and Axel's cry of, "Pym, you bastard, where are you?" whispered in his ear, Pym had only to wave him away with a combination of the Michael's logic and his own. "You are my country's enemy, even if you were my friend. You are unsound. You had no papers. Sorry."
"Hell are you running with all those reds for?" Sefton Boyd asked drowsily one day, face downward in the grass.
They had driven out to Godstow in his sports car for lunch, and were lying in a meadow above the weir.
"Somebody told me they'd seen you with the coal group. You made a piss-awful speech about the madness of war. Hell's the coal group when it's at home?"
"It's a discussion group run by G.D.H. Cole. It explores avenues of socialism."
"Are they queer?"
"Not that I know of."
"Well, explore somebody else's avenue. I also saw your nasty name on a poster. College Secretary of the Socialist Club. I mean, Christ, you're supposed to be in the grid."
"I like to see all sides," said Pym.
"They're not all sides. We are. They're one side. They've pinched half Europe and they're a band of absolute shits. Take my word for it."
"I'm doing it for my country," Pym said. "It's secret."
"Bollocks," said Sefton Boyd.
"It's true. I get instructions from London every week. I'm in the Secret Service."
like you were in the German army at Grimble's, Sefton Boyd suggested. Like you were Himmler's aunt at Willow's. Like you fucked Willow's wife and your father carried messages for Winston Churchill.
A day came, long spoken of and frequently postponed, when Michael took Pym home to meet his family.
Double first material, Michael warned him, in an advance write-up of his spouse. Mind like a dart, no mercy.
Mrs. Michael turned out to be a ravenous, fast-fading woman in a slashed skirt and a low blouse over an unappetizing chest. While her husband did things in his shed, where he appeared to live, Pym inexpertly mixed the Yorkshire pudding and fought off her embraces until he was obliged to take refuge with the children on the lawn. When it rained, he marched them to the drawing-room and posted them around him in self-defense while he pushed their dinky toys.
"Magnus, what are your father's initials?" Mrs. Michael said, bossily from the doorway.
I remember her voice, querulous and interrogative, as if I had just eaten her last smarty, instead of refusing to pop upstairs with her to bed.
R.T., said Pym.
She was trailing a copy of a Sunday newspaper in her hand, and must have been reading it in the kitchen.
Well, it says here there's an R.T. Pym standing as Liberal candidate for Gulworth North. He's described as a philanthropist and property broker. There can't be two, can there?
Pym took the paper from her.
No, he agreed, staring at Rick's portrait of self with red setter.
There can't. Only you could have told us. I mean, you're terribly rich and superior, I know, but a thing like that is jolly exciting if you're people like us.
Sick with apprehension, Pym returned to Oxford and forced himself to read, if only glancingly, the last four letters from Rick that he had tossed unopened in his desk drawer, next to Axel's copy of Grimmelshausen and other unpaid bills. Inside his camel hair dressing gown, Pym, at 53, was shivering. It had come over him suddenly, as it sometimes did, a fever without a temperature. He had been writing for as long as he had been awake, which, to judge by his beard, was a long time. The shiver turned to a shake, which was how it went. It twisted his neck muscles and gnawed at the backs of his thighs. He started to sneeze. The first sneeze was long and speculative. The second followed it like an answering shot.
They're fighting over me, he thought. The good guys and the bad guys are shooting it out inside me.
Whoops! O God, receive my soul. Whoops! O Lord, forgive him, for he knew not what he did.
Rising, he held one hand over his mouth, and with the other turned up the gas fire. Clutching himself, he began a prisoner's tour of the room's perimeter, dipping into his knees with each stride. From a corner of Miss Dubber's carpet, he paced 10 feet, made a right angle and paced 8 more. He stopped and surveyed the rectangle he had measured. How did Rick endure it? He asked himself. How did Axel? He raised his arms, comparing the cell's breadth with his own wingspan.
Christ, he whispered aloud. I'll hardly fit.
Picking up the reinforced briefcase, which he had still not opened, he carried it to the fire and sat there, brows drawn, eyes glowering at the flames, while the shaking grew more violent.
Rick should have died when I killed him.
Pym whispered the words out loud, daring himself to hear it.
You should have died when I killed you.
He returned to his desk and took up his pen.
Every line written is a line behind me. You do it once, then die.
He wrote fast. And as he wrote, he began to smile again. Love is whatever you can still betray, he thought. Betrayal can only happen if you love. Mary, too, was praying. She was kneeling on her school hassock, with her eyes plunged into the nighttime of her palms, and she was praying that she was not at school any more, but at their little Saxon church in Plush that went with the estate, with her father and brother kneeling protectively to either side of her, and their colonel, the Reverend High Anglican Vicar, barking out his fire orders and rattling the incense like a mess gong. Or that she was kneeling at her own bedside in her own room in her nightdress, with her hair brushed and her bottle